It's Thursday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, heavy fighting and concerns for civilians in the battle for Fallujah. John Kerry about to visit the Middle East and Asia. Financial markets waiting for OPEC ministers to meet.
You know, the more understanding we have of the mechanism of disease for all these families allow us to develop different treatments for different forms of the disease.
New genetic discoveries could solve multiple sclerosis. Also ahead, personal turmoils emerge for a top Hollywood actor. It's all in today's International Edition. Islamic State fighters are putting up stiff resistance to an Iraqi military offensive to liberate the western city of Fallujah, launching a four-hour counteroffensive Tuesday in the southern part of the city that Iraq said was repelled. Iraq's counterterrorism service, regular army units, and Shiite militia backed by airstrikes began their assault Monday from three directions. Islamic State fighters have occupied the city since January 2014. The fierce fighting has raised concerns over the fate of an estimated 50,000 residents, including an estimated 20,000 children still believed to be trapped in Fallujah and lacking access to food and health care. Lisa Grande is the deputy special representative of the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq.
We understand that there are widespread food shortages, and there has been since January, when access to Fallujah became extremely difficult for commercial convoys. I think we would characterize this as is mass food deprivation. Some of the families that have managed to escape have said, look, we cut down to one meal a day in February. By March, we were having to skip meals every two or three days. And sometimes in the course of the week, we're only eating on one, two, at most 3 days of the week.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, said a human catastrophe is unfolding inside Fallujah. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Council Member Carl Shembri in Amman.
We're hearing horrible stories about people who are being either executed or caught in the crossfire or not being allowed to flee their houses from the city center. The people we've received in our displacement camps, now almost 600 families have reached our camps, are all coming from the outskirts of Fallujah. Those who are inside are still trapped, and we are extremely worried about the situation.
What is the food situation?
Extremely dire. People are telling us that they haven't been able to eat food for months on end, except for dried dates or rotting dates, drinking river water, unable to feed their children, their babies. Baby milk has become impossible to buy. It's too expensive. Rice has almost run out, and it's also too expensive for people to buy. And again, the families who are reaching our displacement camps are just relieved, even though they've left everything behind. They're just sighing with relief at the fact that they are out of the battle zone right now and that they can get something finally to eat in months.
There are reports that some, perhaps in the hundreds, could be rounded up by Islamic State and being used as human shields.
We are getting such reports from the people who have fled. It is impossible to know the full extent of the situation unfolding inside Fallujah. We have been unable to enter Fallujah for months now. That's why it's been cut off, besieged, cut off from aid, from supplies, essential supplies, including medical supplies, which have run out.
Carl, in a related development, Reuters news agency is reporting that the UN World Food Program is working on plans that up to 700,000 people could be displaced by a planned offensive to retake Iraq's second biggest city, Mosul, from Islamic State.
Well, we've been hearing reports of the government's intention to launch such an operation. So what is concerning us as a humanitarian agency is that across all of Iraq, there are already 3.4 million people displaced. 10 million Iraqis need some kind of humanitarian assistance. So whatever happens, these civilians cannot be abandoned. Once again, just the funding for the needs of the emergency needs of the Iraqis is just 30% funded for this year. We cannot cope. It's impossible. And the international community needs to step up its funding for the humanitarian response.
Carl Shembri says his group calls on the warring sides to respect international humanitarian law and allow safe passage for civilians to flee and also permit aid to flow in for people trapped by the fighting in Fallujah. We turn now to a developing story out of California. A fatal shooting on the UCLA campus. International Edition's social media correspondent, G.I.B. Lee, joins me in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
I saw many people talking about this online. Mm-hmm. Let's begin with a trending hashtag.
Sure, it's hashtag UCLA shooting, and I've been following the LA Police Department's both Facebook and Twitter accounts. And on Facebook, it shared an image of the official statement and captioned it, "Official statement regarding shooting at UCLA, LAPD on citywide tactical alert." The comment section turned out to be all about gun control for some reason. The most liked comment is a sarcastic remark about how hard it is to control the weapons with government regulations. It reads like this. "Wait, I thought a gun-free zone meant criminals weren't allowed to shoot people there. Am I missing something here?" The second most liked comment is in direct contrast to the top comment. It's also quite sarcastic and reads like this. "You're right, gun-free zones mean nothing. In fact, we should do away with all such ideas. We'll get rid of speed limit, no smoking, drug-free school zone, stop signs, and other such things because people don't pay heed to them either."
Well, it is quite a sensitive subject here in the United States, and we should point out in this particular incident what we know so far. Two people are dead in this shooting, two males, and what they suspect is a murder-suicide. Are the U.S. presidential contenders saying anything about it?
Well, no, not really. Not yet, at least. They're tweeting about different things at this hour. Republican Donald Trump is busy gearing up for his rally in San Jose, California tomorrow. And Democratic contender Hillary Clinton is mostly tweeting about Trump University, which is widely thought of as having fraudulent elements in the curriculum. Bernie Sanders, for his part, is tweeting about environmental issues, especially fracking. Before I go, Jim, I also want to mention LAPD's Twitter account. Its handle is at LAPDHQ, that stands for headquarters. The latest tweet sent about 3 hours ago is on how they will continue to search in the building where the incident took place. Back to you, Jim.
Thank you for that update and the wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments to our Twitter feed at VOA_IE. And if you like, tag myself and G on those tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson. And at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that we're following in Asia, gunmen storm Afghan courthouse, target judicial officers. Thailand tipping toward TPP. U.S. drone strike in Pakistan renews calls for transparency. North Korea state media calls Donald Trump a wise politician. Political motives seen in Beijing's warning on Himalayan Viagra. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The top U.S. diplomat, Secretary of State John Kerry, is about to make another visit to the Middle East, and then he's off to Mongolia and China. International Edition host Susan Yaki gets more on the trip from VOA's State Department correspondent Nike Ching.
Remember more than 2 years ago in April of 2014, when a peace process that he brokered fell apart, Secretary Kerry did not give up hope for a lasting agreement to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then he did not give up the vision of a two states for two peoples, living side by side in peace and security. Now, the French-led initiative on June 3rd is aimed at helping to move beyond the current stalemate. The participants will include ministers and delegates from the so-called Middle East Quartet, that is the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. The gathering of the ministers is planned to pave the way for an international conference to set new parameters for negotiating a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Then it's off to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. What will Kerry be doing there?
Interesting. He will arrive on a rare destination of his globe-trotting career as a top U.S. diplomat in Mongolia, where he will meet with high-level senior government officials. And Kerry will also host a town hall with young leaders and attend a traditional Mongolia cultural festival. Now, Mongolia is interestingly located between two big countries, China and Russia. China and Russia are the big single-party regimes, and Mongolia has a very young democracy and maintain a very good relations, majorly the trade and cultural relations with the United States. Susan.
The final stop, Beijing, but there have been some tensions recently between the U.S. and China.
Exactly, and the timing is, as some analysts think, is very diplomatically inconvenient, because the high-level talk of the so-called U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue will take place on June 6 to 7, which is 2 days after the 27th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square incident. The United States will not gloss over thorny issues with China. They will include the human rights practice, South China Sea tensions, and cybersecurity. The United States senior officials are expected to raise concerns over a new Chinese law that will manage foreign non-governmental organizations and low civil society organizations and their Chinese partners to operate in China. Now, in South China Sea, anxieties have been growing in the region over China's aggressive approach to its territorial claims in disputed waters in the South China Sea, although experts think the narrowing between Washington and Beijing in this hot issue is not likely. It is helpful to talk.
VOA State Department correspondent Nike Ching. OPEC, lower auto sales, and a downgrade in sports apparel. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York to tell us more.
OPEC ministers are going to gather in Vienna for the group's biannual meeting, and the tone sounds a bit more upbeat than it has in the past. Recall that oil prices have risen over 80% since the $26 low that we hit back in February. And the general consensus is that OPEC will leave the current strategy in place. The key this time around is demand is stronger than expected, helped by declining U.S. production, outages in Canada and Nigeria, particularly in the Niger Delta. So demand in the first quarter was driven by India, and that has now taken over from China as the main growth market for oil. So I think what's interesting here is for over the past 18 months to 2 years, we've been talking about the supply glut, and now the conversation is geared towards demand and drawdowns.
Beyond OPEC, what else are investors looking at today?
Well, to open up the stock market for trading in June, Ford and General Motors and other automobile manufacturers took a hit after reporting lower U.S. vehicle sales in May due to weak demand for sedans and fewer selling days. Trucks and SUVs remain the industry's most popular vehicles, which generally offer higher profit margins. But you have to remember, autos are in what's called a cyclical industry. So sales ebb and flow based on the replacement cycle. But in general, they've been on an upswing since the financial crisis started. And many investors hold positions in stocks like Ford because of the dividend. So it could be viewed as a value play here to potentially pick up some shares. But I always recommend that investors, after an event like sales numbers or earnings, give the stock a few days to consolidate and let the noise play out so you can kind of establish what the new range is going to be. In other stock-related news, retailers like Nike and Under Armour, they've capitalized on the athleisure trend. That's your yoga pants, your sports bras, your trendy tank tops. But this morning, Under Armour management decided to cut guidance going forward, and Nike got a downgrade from analyst at Morgan Stanley as they warned that Nike's competition is increasing. I'm not so sure if athleisure is weakening. Consumers are pickier than ever with discretionary income, and I think that's really what the true trend is right now in retail.
We've had a good financial workout with Jill Malandrino from New York. Jill, thanks for the latest.
All right, thank you.
Well, what is the deal with actor Johnny Depp? There's much discussion going on, and we'll hear more in just a moment. But first, scientists have discovered that a single genetic mutation can cause multiple sclerosis. The new evidence could lead to a cure for a disease that cripples millions of people, as VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
It's long been thought that multiple sclerosis was caused by some vague interplay among certain genes that made contracting MS more likely when triggered by some environmental factor, such as a viral infection or vitamin deficiency. But Canadian researchers have discovered, at least in cases of a severe form of MS called primary progressive, that a single mutated gene can dramatically increase the risk for developing the neurological disorder. Medical geneticist Carlos Villarino-Goel, a senior author of a paper published in the journal Neuron, notes that 15 to 20% of MS cases were thought to be hereditary, but that's never been proved.
The other genes that were previously described increased the risk of disease by about, at most 3%. With this mutation, your risk is 60 to 70%. So that's a 600 to 700 increase in comparison to the general population. And that's what really makes this completely different from the previous genetic findings.
Mice with a normal copy of NR1H3 developed neurological problems when the gene was knocked out. The problems included a decrease in the production of myelin, a protein insulation on the outside of neurons that speeds the electrical impulses that control movement. A common symptom of multiple sclerosis is muscle weakness and a loss of coordination. Currently, drugs to treat it only slow down progression of the disease. They do not cure it. Discovery of a single genetic defect as the cause of MS, according to Villarino-Goel, could mean it may one day be possible to repair the gene, curing the crippling neurological disorder.
The more understanding we have of the mechanism of disease for all these families allow us to develop different treatments for different forms of the disease.
Researchers will also continue their search for a single genetic cause for the most common form of multiple sclerosis, relapsing remitting MS, in the hopes that it too might be cured. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You may read more about the MS gene discovery at voanews.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at The Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A lot of the latest entertainment talk surrounds one particular Hollywood actor whose wife just gave a deposition to police about abuse. Well, joining VOA's Lori London to talk about it is Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Perros.
Obviously, the big story that everybody has been talking about almost for the past week is Johnny Depp and his split from his wife of just 15 months, Amber Heard. And there's been a lot of back and forth between the two actors, kind of a he said, she said, what's the real truth? And now we're just really starting to realize that there's basically three sides to the story, his version, her version, and the truth. So what we know so far, we had just confirmed on ET Online, is I'm sure you remember when Johnny had broken his hand March of last year while he was filming Pirates of the Caribbean 5 out in Australia. Everybody, it was this mysterious hand injury, and the movie studio basically confirmed and released a statement that something happened off set where Johnny broke his hand and he needed to fly to the United States for last-minute surgery. And what we have just confirmed today from multiple sources is that Johnny actually had injured his hand from punching a wall during an argument with Amber. We know that, you know, production was halted for about a month. Amber then had left Australia to head to London to film The Danish Girl. So I think there's a lot more things that are going to come out of this nasty split, and I don't think it's going to quiet down anytime soon.
Wow, so sad all the way around.
Really is sad. And, you know, a lot of people close to Johnny are coming to his defense. I mean, his ex-girlfriend and the mother of his children, Vanessa Paradis, had come out this past weekend in a letter to TMZ and said, you know, Johnny had never physically, verbally attacked me at all. He was never violent towards me or our children. I'd never seen that side of him. And then Johnny's daughter, Lily Rose, who we hear is a very close friend of Amber's, said, you know, my father would never hurt a fly. He is the nicest man I've ever met.
Any other big stories you guys are working on?
More sad news out of Los Angeles. Of course, the former S.H.I.E.L.D. actor Michael Jace was finally convicted after a week-long trial of second-degree murder of his wife, April. We are hearing that the incident happened in front of the couple's two young children 2 years ago. There was a lot of back and forth of what really happened. You know, Michael had said it kind of was he took a shotgun out and just wanted to shoot her in the leg to scare her a little bit, and that turned into three shots that eventually killed her. So an incredibly sad story, something that two young children should never have to see, and the famous actor was finally found guilty. And he's going to appear court for sentencing on June 10th, and he could face 40 years to life in a state prison.
Thanks to Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Perros. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director, as always, Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Law enforcement and the rule of law in Pakistan got a boost recently with some assistance from the United States. Last month, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan David Hale and Pakistan Economic Affairs Division Secretary Tariq Bajwa signed a one-year, $48.6 million bilateral assistance agreement. Under the agreement, the U.S. Department of State's International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Bureau will provide support to the government of Pakistan in building Pakistan's law enforcement capability, fighting illicit narcotics, and strengthening its criminal justice system. The United States signed the first such bilateral assistance agreement in 1982. Subsequent yearly agreements have supported the training of tens of thousands of police officers and prosecutors, construction of police stations, and provision of vehicles, equipment, and life-saving personal protective gear for law enforcement agents. The new agreement will fund several programs throughout Pakistan, including initiatives to improve the capability and reach of provincial police and other law enforcement institutions through training, equipment, and infrastructure support. Programs will also support women's access to the justice system, as well as support the recruitment, retention, and advancement of women as police officers, prosecutors, and judges. In addition, programs will help Pakistan interdict illegal narcotics, arrest and prosecute drug traffickers, fund crop substitution and agricultural training programs for poppy farmers, and provide small-scale irrigation, hydroelectric systems, and farm-to-market roads in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Lastly, it will promote rule of law by providing training to provincial and federal prosecutors and judges in effective trial advocacy and to corrections officials in modern prison administration. The Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs works in more than 90 countries to help them combat crime and corruption, counter drug-related crime, improve police institutions, and promote laws and court systems that are fair and accountable. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, to support a criminal justice system that serves and protects the people of Pakistan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.